Okay, so yeah, very, very warm welcome to all of you, particularly if you've just joined us. This morning we had a morning of meditation and chanting and readings, particularly focused around Manjushri, whose image is on the shrine there. We chanted his mantra more or less successfully, one time less successfully, one time more successfully. We did the metta bhavana, and in the metta bhavana in particular, and also the other meditations, I was encouraging us to, in a way, imagine Manjushri's presence, imagine his wisdom and love as forces in the universe that we could just open up to, rather than having to think in terms of me cultivating metta. Think in terms of me getting out of the way, letting go of myself clinging, so that something else could come through, so that the force that Manjushri represents could come through. And I was saying that that force is a reality. It is a reality in the universe that we can experience. Anything that stops us experiencing that is our own self clinging. So that was a little bit about this morning. And then we had lunch, so thank you very much for those of you who brought lunch, very, very nice spread. And then this afternoon I'm going to talk a little bit more about Manjushri. But before we do that, let's salute the shrine again, because some of us haven't been here, so we'll salute the shrine. So, when I was asked to think of a programme for the day, actually, until last week, I hadn't thought of a programme for the day, and it was only Maitreya Bandhu who pointed that out, and we had to, I had to somehow think of a programme so that we could get a leaflet out, etc. Anyway, I said that I'd give a talk, but I don't intend to actually do a formal talk. What I'd like to do is just talk about Manjushri, and I think we can have it quite informal, so it'd be quite nice to have some questions and answers. In particular, what I'd like to do is just explore this image. This image is, obviously it's a painting of Manjushri that was that I commissioned Chintamani to paint for me. And I can really say that for me it's an image that I've fallen in love with the image, and it has become an image that speaks to me at all sorts of levels of the goal of the spiritual life. But it speaks to me very personally. And I'll try and sort of unpack that as we go. And maybe you can see things in the image that I can't, or maybe you'll have resonances that are particular to you. But particularly, yeah, I'll try and just draw out what resonates for me in the image. I know some of you are sitting at the back, and it might not be so obvious to you. Some of the detail of the figure might not be so visible to you. So at some point, do come and have a look at the painting. I'll be trying to draw out some of the detail. Hi, do come on in. So the first thing I wanted to, in a way, reiterate, which I was saying this morning, is that at the LBC it's the year of spiritual rebirth, and Manjushri is the chosen deity, bodhisattva figure that we've chosen for this year to personify spiritual rebirth. It's all very well talking in terms of ideas and concepts like spiritual rebirth. But Bhante said that actually we need a transcendental object. We need some sort of object that personifies the goal for us. And you could say that that is the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. But also, what I think happens, not I think happens, Bhante says happens, and it does happen, is that the enlightened mind is such a multifaceted, rich mind, such a rich experience, that it breaks out into new forms. It can't necessarily be just contained in one image, in one form. Its very nature, I think, is to communicate itself. And what that means is forms of communication. Those forms of communication can be conceptual, but they'll also be symbolic. There'll also be images and symbols that point to different aspects of the enlightened mind. And the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, are this breaking out of enlightenment into form, into forms that we can hopefully resonate with, that touch something deep within us and yet go beyond us. So they speak to us very deeply, and yet they point beyond our own experience to a reality that lies beyond self, beyond self-clinging. So for me, this image of Manjushri is one such form, and it's a form that, as I say, speaks to me very, very much, at least personally. But the year of spiritual rebirth is, we're trying particularly to get a taste, a glimpse of the goal. I think it's really important, right from the word go in our spiritual lives, in our involvement with the Dharma, that we have some sort of idea of what the goal is. In some ways, talking about the goal is problematic, because at some point in the spiritual life, I think you have to sort of let go of any notion of goals and achievements and anything that I can appropriate for me. And so at some point, I think we have to sort of, let go. But nevertheless, what's really important is that we have confidence that if I do let go, particularly if we let go of self-clinging, that something very, very positive, something new and extremely positive, will arise. And it'll arise in us. And yet, it won't be about us. So this idea of spiritual rebirth is something that we all need to, each of us, have some sort of feeling for. What does it mean for us? And in a way, we've already got some sort of taste of it, otherwise we wouldn't be here. But probably we need to consciously think about, when is it that we've had, well, our most significant heightened experiences of a meaning that goes beyond us, of a sense of something real that is beyond the ego. All of us have had some sort of glimpse of that. Manjushri and these other figures, these other archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattva figures, are ways in into those heightened experiences. They're like doorways into this realm of meaning and symbolism. So sometimes people say, are they real or are they not? Are they somehow internal psychological tools, or are they external realities? And of course Buddhism says neither and both. Neither and both. The whole notion of something that's purely internal or purely external is an abstraction that doesn't exist in reality. They're neither and both. The image of a rainbow is sometimes used, isn't it? The image, the metaphor of a rainbow is sometimes used. So you think of a rainbow in the sky, this beautiful semicircle of light, and you ask yourself, is it real? Or is it in my mind? And actually, it's neither and both. It really does seem to exist, have some sort of independent existence of me, because other people can look at it and say, oh yes, I see it. You can even photograph a rainbow, and it'll come out on your photograph. You try and touch it, and it's not there. It's actually an image that's been formed in your mind. by your eyes, by light of certain wavelengths being refracted by droplets of water in the sunlight, and your mind, our minds, construct this image. So it's said that a rainbow hovers between existence and non-existence. Well, you could say, I'm saying, that it hovers between existence and non-existence. And that's what these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are said to do. They hover between existence and non-existence. And actually, so does everything else. If you really examine the nature of perception, it's no longer possible to say what's out there independently of the perceiver. It's no longer makes any sense to say what does anything look like, feel like, taste like, sound like, touch like, smell like, without a perceiver. The very notion of something looking like something, or sounding like something, or smelling like something, or touch feeling like something, is based on the notion of senses and of perception. So, for example, I was talking about the sun earlier on, Manjugosha being a solar symbol associated with the sun, and in this painting, he's emerging from the sun in the cosmos, this great ball of exploding energy in the cosmos. And, I think of the sun as being very, very loud. Goodness knows how many millions of tons of hydrogen are being turned into helium every second in this nuclear fusion reaction that's going on in the heart of the sun that is the sun. But of course in space, sound doesn't have any meaning. Because if there's no air, there's no vibrations in air, and you wouldn't hear the sun. You could be standing right next to it, as it were, and you wouldn't hear it. There would be nothing to hear. Do you see what I mean? That the very notion of all of our sense experience depends on our senses. And you change either the senses or the conditions around it, and your experience would be very, very different. Our experience would be very, very different. So to say whether something exists or not is a very subjectively influenced thing. It's a simplification of what's going on in reality. All I can say is that if you open up to these symbols, Manjugosha or any other Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, if you're willing to open up in an imaginative way, if you're willing in a way to fall in love with them and let go of selfishness and clinging to ego, then they arise in you as a real experience. They arise in you as a real experience. And they seem to have an independent existence of us. It's as if they exist as forces in the universe that then not only touch you, but potentially transform us. Yeah, so for me, Manjugosha is one such doorway. One such doorway. Let me just pause there and see if I've confused everybody or whether that does that. Yeah. Okay, so looking at this image, this particular painting, this particular form of Manjugosha, I think I want to start from the outside and then work in a little bit. And I want to start with the framing of the image. I don't know if you can see, all of you can see, but on the four corners of the frame, there are these terrifying, monstrous faces, heads. And they're heads of wrathful Vajrapani, another Bodhisattva figure. They're demonic looking. The hair on those heads is on fire. And there's a garland of a crown of skulls on each of the faces. And for me, and this is sort of me speaking more personally, this wrathful form of Vajrapani symbolizes spiritual death. it symbolizes that I will have to die to my egotism in order to walk through this door where there's Manjudosha. I will have to let go of everything that I know and everything that I think of as me. And sometimes when I, in my inspired states, that feels, doesn't feel frightening. That feels beautiful and liberating. In my less inspired states, when I'm more constricted by my craving and my anxiety and my sense of meanness, the very notion that I'll have to let all of that go is terrifying. And the wrathful form of Vajrapani is a challenge for me to keep going, to keep letting go. That roaring figure who's wreathed in fire. Fire for me just feels very evocative of this whole phase of spiritual death. Light will be a burning away. Just as in after physical death, if the body is cremated, there's a burning away, and you're left with, well, you're left with ash. Yeah, for me, as a fire is that symbol for a metaphorical death, death of egotism. So yeah, Vajrapani guards the entrance to this door. He's like a guardian, and only if you're prepared to surrender are you allowed in. Yeah, are you allowed in? And then you do go in, and you're in the cosmos. So in this image, you're in this vast, infinite space. That space is a metaphor for inner spaciousness. It's a metaphor for the spaciousness of the mind. The mind, when we let go of self, expands without boundaries. There is no boundary. It's only self-making that creates boundaries. So the cosmos, for me, becomes an image for this infinite space, an obvious image for infinite space. But it's also more than just infinitely spacious. I think for me it's an image of wonder, an image of awe. It's an image that puts into context the smallness of me and my concerns. Next to a sun, a star, or a galaxy with a billion suns, or a cluster of galaxies revolving around each other, or a supercluster of clusters of galaxies. Next to all of that, which is reality, which is not just me making it up, it's reality. That is how we exist, isn't it? We're existing on this spinning ball, hurtling through space at goodness knows what sort of speed, thousands of miles an hour, round this burning furnace of a fireball that is just one of billions of suns in this galaxy that we call the Milky Way, that you can look up to, probably not in London, but you can see. And that's just one tiny, tiny galaxy in a, well, in a local cluster that's, you know, got, I don't know, 15 or so galaxies, just, you know, locally. That's our local home. That is our, that's our sort of home. And then you've got countless of those, countless, potentially without any boundaries, potentially an infinite universe. We don't know whether it's finite or not. So within that framework, I only have to sort of try and connect with that. And my usual concerns of what's for supper are really put into context. Or do they really like me? Or etc., etc., are put into context. And that is a truer context. It's a real context. Let me just read you what... Yeah, this is Carl Sagan talking about the cosmos. Carl Sagan was a cosmologist and astronomer who, I think he died in the late 1990s, possibly. The size and the age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding. Lost somewhere between immensity and eternity is our tiny planetary home. In a cosmic perspective, most human concerns seem insignificant, even petty. And yet, our species is young and curious and brave and shows much promise. In the last few millennia, we have made the most astonishing and unexpected discoveries about the cosmos and our place within it. Explorations that are exhilarating to consider. They remind us that humans have evolved to wonder, that understanding is a joy, that knowledge is prerequisite to survival. I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. So for me, this image is trying to speak of something of that awe and wonder and vastness. So you've got this cosmos. And I think we could do well to reflect on the fact that we are floating like a mote of dust in the morning sky. Sometimes people say that, oh, well, that sort of vastness, that sort of infinite, eternal, perhaps, vastness just feels terrifying and cold. And because my concerns feel so small, does that mean that we're insignificant? Does that mean that there's no meaning to human existence? Well, Carl Sagan argues otherwise, and I believe otherwise, and the Dharma says otherwise. It says that no, human life is very, very, very significant. It's of cosmic significance because it's through the human form that we can realise the truth of reality, that we can wake up to Buddhahood. And in a Buddha, it's as if the whole evolved cosmos, the whole evolving cosmos, reaches its peak, its zenith. It reaches self-awareness. It knows itself in the enlightened mind. And we are potentially those enlightened beings. So, yes, our place in this cosmos is of immense, immense significance. This life is of immense significance. And again, it's only our pettiness that stops us, my pettiness, stops me from knowing the full significance of what it is to be alive. So yes, for a Buddhist, the cosmos isn't just some alien, cold, impersonal, vast landscape, vast universe that we have to hide from. It's our very birthright. In that cosmos at the bottom of the image, you've got this swirling gas cloud, like a spiral nebula, like a galaxy, a spiral galaxy being formed. And that, to me, speaks of form arising from emptiness. We're so cultured, indoctrinated, conditioned, I mean, to think of form as being solid and real and objective and out there. We seldom really experience the fluid, empty nature of things. But of course that is how they are. Modern physics tells us that atoms are mostly empty. and even the bits of the atom that isn't empty, like little bits of particles, they don't have any essential substance behind them. They're energy. They're energy that coagulates and condenses into form, and can ease just as easily disperse again into formless energy. At the heart of Buddhism, at the heart of Buddhist wisdom, at least at the heart of the Pranyaparamita texts, there's this notion of form and emptiness. There's this notion that there's no such thing as things. And there's nothing solid, there's no essence behind anything. There is just a coming together of conditions. And for me, the metaphor of energy is a good metaphor. Had the Buddha known about energy, he might have used that term. But you could think of all form, the whole universe, as just manifestations, temporary manifestations, flowing, changing manifestations of energy. And this spiral cloud, this dust cloud, speaks to me of that. This form arising out of nothingness, seemingly nothingness. In physics, for example, there's no such thing as a as empty space. Not really empty space. When physicists think about a vacuum, you know, a vacuum, when we think about a vacuum, you think of empty space, don't you, with nothing in it. Well, physicists now think of a vacuum as full of energy, with that energy manifesting as tiny, tiny particles for tiny, tiny moments of time, so quickly appearing and disappearing that you can't ever say that they fully exist. They're called virtual particles because they don't sort of fully exist. And yet, that is what a vacuum is. It's a sea of energy that's bubbling away with virtual particles, with energy, an immense amount of energy, just arising and taking form and then falling back. So you've got this dust cloud, which is, well, in these spiral nebula, that's how stars form. So gas seems to condense under the law of gravity. Sort of gas in the universe will, you know, be drawn together. And then gravity pulls more and more of it together, closer and closer, until it becomes denser and denser, until stars form. Stars are just gas falling in on itself under the law of gravity. So out of this particular dust cloud, well, you haven't just got a star, you've got a lotus. First of all, you've got a lotus forming. That's poetic license. Physics wouldn't recognise these big lotuses floating on spiral nebula. But the lotus, of course, is a symbol for our potential for spiritual growth and ultimately for enlightenment. The lotus appeared, didn't it, in the symbol that the Buddha, when the Buddha was very, very, very newly enlightened, it said that he, you know, he was deliberating whether he could communicate anything of this experience, this experience that is beyond all words and all concepts, whether he could communicate any of that to anybody. He was doubting whether he could. And he looks around, as it were, in his imagination, and what he sees is that humanity is like a lake or a bed of lotus flowers. And those lotus flowers are in different stages of unfoldment, as illustrated on these hangings. Some are submerged, barely emerged from the mud. Others have emerged from the mud but are completely engulfed in the water and can't open in the water. And then others have started to break free of the surface of the water and have started to open out in sunlight. And others are almost fully open in the sunlight. That's how he saw human potential, human beings. That's what we really are. Do you see what I mean? We're not anything else. Modern science would see us as biological machines, or consumerism would see us as customers, or sometimes we see ourselves as, children or partners, husbands, wives, barristers, doctors, whatever it is. But actually, we're unfolding potential lotuses. That would be a better, truer description of what it is to be a human being. So here you've got this lotus made of light. All of this image is made of light. This blue light. Blue light is somehow wonderful, isn't it? It's somehow mysterious. I don't know why it's wonderful. But even Christmas time when you've got street lights, sometimes you get those sort of blue lights in trees, don't you? And blue light feels to me slightly, slightly more magical. Because of its darkness, its dark light. Anyway, this blue lotus is unfolding, this blue lotus of light is unfolding out of this cosmic structure. Yeah. So let me just pause there and say, is there anything else that you can see in this image, apart from the figure itself? Which we'll come on to. We'll come on to the figure in a moment. What strikes you? Yeah.
Could you say something about the sun and moon?
The sun and moon. In the two top corners, you've got this sun and moon, which is traditional in Tibetan tankas. You have a moon and a sun on them. And in this image, I've asked Chintamani, well, Chintamani's very beautifully painted them, as when you look more closely, they look like interplanetary objects that might be, for example, circling round this star. They look like, sort of interplanetary objects. But the sun and moon, they're symbols there are two ways that I've heard it talked about. One is that you've got the sun, the full sort of moon and the sun in the image at the same time, which is pointing to something beyond time, outside of the normal temporal order of things. This image isn't an image of something that is existing in time. It's beyond space and time. So the sun and moon appearing together like that are, you could say, a pointer to something beyond the temporal. And in the meditation practice, in the sadhana practice associated with Manjudosha, there's a verse which talks of us as us unenlightened beings as being imprisoned in temporal existence. We're imprisoned in temporal existence. This body, these bodies, exist in space and time, and it's as if we're imprisoned by those two constraints of space and time. Actually, only one constraint, space-time. It imprisons us. The enlightened mind, our own potential mind, doesn't exist in space and time. Or it exists outside of space and time. Maybe it's better to say that it's space and time exist within it. Space and time are unfolding within something, as it were, outside of space and time. But that's where language breaks down. To say outside implies space. So yes, the sun and moon, I think, are pointing to something transcendental. Or saying that this image is of something transcendental, if you see what I mean. They're also associated, aren't they? The lunar and the solar are associated with the masculine and the feminine. The lunar with the feminine and the the solar with the masculine. And what you've got there in an enlightened being is a complete integration of masculine and feminine energies. Yeah, a complete integration of all aspects of our being. All of us have masculine and feminine energies within us. And to identify too narrowly with our gender is to miss the point. Sure, our bodies are of a particular gender, but that's only a kind of... The enlightened mind doesn't recognise that. Race, gender, any other normal... any other kind of conditioning that we identify with is only relatively true. It's only relatively true. So, yes, the masculine and the feminine coming together. Yeah, does that...
Can you say something about the moon mat?
Yeah, the moon mat. Yeah. So you've got this lotus, this blue lotus of light, very beautifully painted here, I think, unfolding. Before the moon mat, you've got these stamens of the lotus, these orange stamens, which, as it were, prefigure the figure. They're intimating that Manjudosha is about to appear on this figure, on this mat, on this lotus, as it were. All the colour world of this is contained in the lotus, in those stamens, and in the white of the moon mat. The moon mat itself, resting on the lotus, is, well, you could say it's a symbol for purity. That's how I've heard it explained. Others might know of other symbolism. It's pure white. It's white light. It's spotless. Actually, here, on this particular image, it's reflecting the orange. But it's pure white. And white, of course, is often a universal symbol for purity. Mm. And in this case, it's ethical purity. Not anything else, as it were. You know, Hinduism is obsessed with purity in a ritual sense. You have to have all sorts of rituals to purify yourself, and including bathing in filthy waters and rivers to purify yourself. Or Christianity is obsessed with sexual purity, so you have to be a virgin in order to be pure. Or this is ethical purity, natural morality at its height. This is ethical purity. This is karma niyama processes at their best. This is our potential ethical purity. It's out of ethical purity that something transcendent can arise. And in a way, that's what the transcendental figure sits on. He sits on that, the moon mat. I don't know if anybody else has anything to add about the moon mat. I might not. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly concur. In my own practice, I think of it as pristine.
Pristine.
I love the word.
Yeah.
It has a feel of expansiveness.
Yes. Yeah.
And just absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's radiant, isn't it? It's radiant.
Yes.
It shines.
Yes.
It shines. Because I think, for me, when I first was ordained, purity was a dirty word. I kind of wasn't drawn to the notion of becoming more pure. That just felt like becoming more weak or insipid or good in a not a very attractive way. Real purity is nothing of those things. It's nothing of those things. It's pristine, it's radiant, it's strong, it's immaculate. It's the basis on which the transcendental arises. It's on the basis on which the transcendental sits. So then you come to the figure himself. Well, I guess before we come onto the figure, you've got this body aura of the sun. You've got the sun arising from this lotus. So a star being born, our star. The sun, for me... well, it speaks of not just the natural world at its most awe-inspiring, but also it speaks of life. It speaks as the source of all things. It's the source, it's what keeps us alive. It's what makes life possible. Life on this earth, anyway. It's what makes it possible. It's the source of everything. It's there in the sky, at least I'm told it's there in the sky. You wouldn't know it more recently, but it's there in the sky. But it makes everything possible, makes life possible, and we're hurtling around it, revolving around it. We're completely locked in into the sun, and yet you can't look at it. We can feel its warmth, we can bathe in its light and warmth, and without it we'd die, and yet you can't look at it. You know it's there, but unless you're wearing really, really good shades, you wouldn't dare lift your gaze to stare at it, because it would blind you. It would blind you with its immense, immense energy and brightness. So it's something that is both the source of life, that's incredibly attractive, but is also potentially completely destructive. Yeah? And one day the sun will consume the earth. It will expand into a red giant that will consume the earth. It will destroy this planet if we haven't already destroyed it before. So yes, the sun is the source of everything. It gives birth to everything. But you can't look at it. And for me, that becomes a symbol of the transcendental. If I were to see reality as it really is, and when I say the transcendental, I mean in inverted commas rather than as a thing, but if I were to see things as they really are, they would burn me away. And the me that it would burn away is my egotism, my selfishness, my delusion of a fixed and separate entity that's clinging to this life and this body and to everything that can make me comfortable and happy. I cling we cling for dear life, and that clinging would be burned away by the sun. If I could really see reality, that would burn me away. And that would be the doorway to liberation, to real freedom. So the sun for me is this image of what is both extremely attractive, what is the goal of human existence, and yet it threatens the very notion of me. Yeah. And of course Manjudosha is born in this image of the sun. He is of the sun. He is of the same stuff, which is emptiness. He's born of the sun. And it's like he is somebody that I can look at. I can't stare at the sun, but I can at Manjudosha. It's like the sun coming down to meet me in a form that I can see. Not only see, but contemplate, listen to, move towards, fall in love with. So it's reality stepping down towards us. In form. So again, you've got this form and emptiness. You've got this figure emerging as form out of this vast energy that is the sun. So what do you notice about the figure?
Why is he wearing so much jewellery?
Yeah, let's come on to whether he's a gentleman at all, and then we can come on to the jewellery. So the bodhisattvas are depicted as androgynous beings. So in a way, he's only he relatively. And in this image, he's a very feminized figure. So yes, he's meant to be very youthful, for example. So he's meant to be like a 16-year-old. So he's meant to be a prince, a royal prince, an Indian prince, a 16-year-old prince. And at 16, it's just that cusp of a youth turning into a man. And he's particularly in this figure, I think he is, there's this androgyny about him. You can't quite tell. And again, it's not an androgyny that is this sort of weird kind of asexual kind of being. It's transcending this whole notion of gender. It's transcending masculinity and femininity. Something other than that, rather than some sort of compromise between the two. The jewellery itself, so he's got a necklace, he's got bracelets, he's got anklets, he's got earrings, he's got a crown. They all kind of mean something, but essentially it's the richness of the enlightened mind. It's when we contemplate Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, we often contemplate him as dressed in rags, in this patched robe that he, you know, initially when he went forth from his father's house, he swapped robes with a beggar, swapped clothes with a beggar, and so you've got these patched, torn, tattered garments of utter poverty, of renunciation, that he drapes himself in. And Shakyamuni is, for me, he evokes that renunciative ideal. What emerges in the enlightened mind is unparalleled richness. And the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the archetypal dimension are trying to depict that richness. And how do you depict richness? You depict it, at least in the Indian Indo-Tibetan tradition, you depict it in jewels and silks. That's what royalty would have worn. Yeah? Yeah.
I tend to think of it, if I may.
Yeah, I do.
In terms of the myth of the return journey.
Ah.
He left, Shakyamuni left.
Yes.
Threw off
yes.
The royal garb.
Yes.
Jewellery, the horse went, everything went, he cut his hair.
Yes.
And in the return journey, he returns as a...
As a prince, as a... As a, as a, as a
yes.
Yeah, he does. And in a way, you could say that this is the return. Yeah. Yeah. The myth of the return journey is very resonant, isn't it? Because it speaks, the return journey, the myth of the return journey, again, speaks of something, our true potential beyond space and time. In this spatial, temporal existence, we're more like the beggars and the worn-out beings, at least some of us are. And but the potential, the true potential of the enlightened mind, which is our potential, is revealed in images of richness and images of light. They're not even just jewels, they're jewels made of light. Everything's made of this glorious, scintillating light. Yeah. His crown, though, his crown is of particular significance. His crown, so he's wearing the crown of a prince, an Indian prince, and it has five jewels on the crown. And the five jewels are the colours of the five archetypal Buddhas of the mandala. Akshobhya, Ratnasambhava, Amitabha, Amodhasiddhi and Virochana. And that's because he is the personification of the wisdom of all of them. They sit on the crown of his head. He is enlightened wisdom in all its richness, all its facets, completely integrated into one form. So that the five jinnas, as they're called, the five victors, the five Buddhas of the archetypal mandala, adorn the crown of his head. And he's bathed in the nectar of their wisdom.
This book he's holding with the like symbol in the middle of it.
Yes, the book.
Yeah, what's the meaning of the
symbol?
The symbol in the middle.
In the middle of the book. Okay, I'll come on to that. That's well spotted actually, because that does require some explication. But I just want to finish with the crown. On the crown above the five jewels representing the five Buddhas, on this figure, and this is just this painting, it's not particularly traditional in the Tibetan iconography of Manjushri, but on this figure, there's the figure of Vajrasattva on the crown of the crown, as it were, a tiny, tiny figure of Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva being sometimes he's called the sixth Buddha, and he is in a way the personification of all the Buddhas, but particularly Vajrasattva represents our own innate enlightened potential. The fact that all of us are potentially Buddhas. Vajrasattva represents that innate purity. But the book. So let's come on to the book and then I'll explain the symbol. So, I was saying earlier this morning, the book is the book of wisdom. It's the perfection of wisdom that he's holding to his heart. But what does a book mean? You don't have to kind of know that. Well, it helps if you know that. But what does a book kind of mean to us?
Literature.
Literature, yeah.
Knowledge.
Knowledge.
Man-made.
Something man-made.
Learning.
Learning.
Potentially, you don't have to read it, but the stuff within.
There's stuff within that's potentially secret or not, yeah. Yeah. So you've got wisdom, knowledge, learning, something man-made, something that's got potential in it. You've got human culture, haven't you? You've got human culture represented by the symbol of a book.
Education.
Education, yeah. Everything that lifts us above animal life can be symbolised by a book. On the Wheel of Life, in the different realms of the Wheel of Life, the Buddha appears, and Avalokiteshvara appears, or he appears sometimes as Avalokiteshvara, but the Buddha appears, and he bears an implement for each realm to help the beings in that realm move towards enlightenment. And in the animal realm, he holds a book, because that's what distinguishes us from the animals. You could say, at least symbolically, not scientifically, but symbolically, it's culture, it's knowledge, it's learning, it's education that lifts us beyond the animal. And that's true in our own lives, isn't it? That is how often we rise to a higher humanity through education. Those that are deprived in the world of education, of learning, of human culture, their lives exist on the level of survival very often. Yeah? And survival is the level at which animals have to exist. So culture and learning can, you could say that that's what defines the truly human. He holds this book to the heart. And Manjushri is associated, he's associated with culture and learning. He's associated, for example, with all the arts and the sciences. I'm told that in the Tibetan tradition, these figures can be taken very literally, much more literally than we would try and take them in Tri Ratna. But in the Tibetan tradition, if you were needing to pass an exam, you'd pray to Manjushri. You'd chant the Manjushri mantra. It would be the he's associated with intelligence, with human culture and knowledge and learning. Now, all of that human culture and learning and intelligence and knowledge, you take that up to a transcendental level, as it were, and you get enlightened wisdom. Enlightened wisdom can't be captured by human learning. There are no concepts or theories that can capture enlightened wisdom. Enlightened wisdom is an experience that goes beyond words. All words, all notions. Notions of me and other notions of space and time. So he, to his heart, is holding not just any old book, but he's holding the book of the perfection of enlightened wisdom. So that, to me, then becomes a magical book. A book that, you know, I'm at my best, what I'm trying to do is devote my life to opening that book, to peering into its pages. And sometimes in my imagination, when I'm visualising Mandragosha in my sadhana, I do, I open the book, and all the pages are blank. All the pages are always blank. On the cover of that book, the book itself is, in this image, is the colour, the dark blue colour of the cosmos. So for me here, it feels like a crystallisation, a condensation of that infinite wisdom of the cosmos, that infinite space, is then condensed into this symbol of a book that he holds to his heart. So that's what he holds. The book in this image is at the centre of the whole painting. Everything revolves around this book. Everything. So it is the book of ultimate wisdom. And it's wisdom that, according to the tradition, it's wisdom that leads to enlightenment. And it's wisdom that then gives birth to compassion. Enlightened compassion and energy and fearlessness and all of those other qualities of the Buddhas. So it's that he's holding. He's holding enlightenment, enlightened wisdom to his heart. And yes, on that book, well, sometimes in my imagination, what I see on the cover of the book is not that symbol, but I see the cosmos passing over the cover of the book, the galaxies and the superclusters and the stars passing over. That's how I sometimes see it. But on this image, that would be hard to paint. And instead, what you've got is a symbol. And it's one letter from the Devanagari alphabet. And it's the letter A. A. Yeah? As in Om Ara Pajanati, Ara, A. So it's one letter. And it's there because in this tradition of the perfection of wisdom, the perfection of wisdom tradition is a tradition where these sutras were compiled, these sutras appeared, these Buddhist sutras appeared, which were pointing at transcendental wisdom. And they were using particular methods to point at transcendental wisdom. What they were doing was negating, undercutting, undermining all conceptual categories. So even the categories of Buddhism were being undercut and negated. So for example, the Heart Sutra is from this perfection of wisdom literature. And in the Heart Sutra you say words like not even wisdom to attain. No suffering or end of it, nor all that comes of suffering. You're negating their categories like the Four Noble Truths of dukkha and going beyond dukkha. You're negating even Buddhist concepts. So that's what the perfection of wisdom tradition was trying to do. In negating concepts, it was trying to open us up to something that went beyond all concepts. Yeah. So the perfection of wisdom tradition started, you had some very, very large sutras. You had some medium-sized sutras, and then you had some very, very large sutras like the perfection of wisdom in 100,000 lines or 100,000 sort of verses. So these vast kind of texts which negated all concepts and used the paradox to try and wake you up. But then the tradition, the literature tradition, the perfection of wisdom literature tradition, started to develop sutras that became shorter and more condensed, until you ended up with sutras like the Heart Sutra, which we can recite in the puja in just a few minutes. So, you know, it's rather than 100,000 lines, it's less than 100 lines. But then the perfection of wisdom tradition, it went to extremes. And there was one sutra that was just one syllable long. One syllable long. And the syllable was A. And A, in the Indian languages, is the syllable that negates something. So if you want to say not something, you say A something. Yeah? It means not. Not this, not that, not anything. So on this text, you've got the symbol A, the syllable which is the perfection of wisdom tradition at its most condensed. And it's saying not anything that we can grab hold of, not anything that we can grasp with our minds, with our ordinary egotistical minds. So maybe we'll talk a little bit more, and then maybe 5 minutes more, and then we'll have a tea break. So yes, this book is at the heart, well, literally at the heart of Manjudosha. In this image, I really like the way he's holding it. It's a Western book. In most Tibetan depictions of Manjudosha, it's a Tibetan text, which is a loose leaf kind of text. Sometimes the text is on a lotus flower, but this is like a Western book, and he's holding it to his heart as you would, in depictions of. So for me, that book is being a Western book. It speaks to me as a Western person. It starts to speak to me of my cultural values. And something that led me to Buddhism was this quest for knowledge. I wanted to know what the truth was. So I started reading about philosophy. And that led me to Eastern philosophy. Not that that all sounds very grand. It's not that I read Kant or anything. I just read popular books. But as a child, that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to approach truth through philosophy. That's what led me to want to do physics, because I thought that a study of physics would unlock the truths of the universe, and then I'd be closer at what reality was. So the book represents that quest for me, that quest for truth, which I tried to do in conceptual ways, philosophy and physics and the like. But this is the transcendental equivalent of that. It also, for me, as a boy, I was fascinated by magic, and I wanted to be a magician. In fact, I was convinced that I was a wizard and could cast spells. And for me, this is the book of spells that you get in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. The book, if you're not ready for it, you open, it will be disastrous. You have to be ready, you have to be initiated before you can even hold this book, let alone open it. So for me, the book is all of those things that he's holding to his heart. Yes, and I'm trying to become ready, as I say, to hold that. That's what I'm trying to do. Very good, welcome back. So yes, I want to continue for a very short while longer. Say a few more things, and then we'll have maybe another 2 minute leg stretch or something, and then we'll conclude the afternoon with a short ritual to Manjudosha, the puja to Manjudosha. looking at this figure, looking at different aspects of the figure, we come to the sword, don't we? So we've talked a little bit about the book and the lotus that he sits on and the sun that he's coming out of, but very obviously in his right hand he's holding this flaming sword, and you can kind of wonder what a figure with a sword is doing in the Buddhist tradition, even though he's holding a book in the other hand. What on earth is he doing with the sword? But the sword is a symbol for the cutting away of delusion, and it's delusion and all of our deluded views that keep us from realizing enlightenment. And he wields this sword, slicing through, cutting through the ignorance that binds us to samsara. And it's a flaming sword. I guess it gives it even more potency and magic. And to me, in this image, it's like he's just dipped his sword into the sun and brought out fire on its blade. And the handle of the sword is a vajra, or half a vajra. So he's holding, and a vajra, of course, is a symbol for, well, the nature of reality. It's a diamond thunderbolt that shatters all egotistical delusion. It's reality in its most sort of energetic, dramatic form. So he's holding this vajra sword. It's not just an ordinary sword. And this vajra sword that's flaming with the fire of the sun. And yes, he cuts through. He cuts through all wrong views. And I think that, I haven't got time today, but it would be worth maybe another time. We'll be exploring, in a way, the sorts of views that he cuts through, the sorts of views that the Dharma cuts through. It's very easy to kind of think that because wisdom is beyond all concepts, that we don't need to worry about our own views. But actually, you can't get to transcendental wisdom without right view. What Bhante is very, very clear about this, Bhante Sangharakshita is very clear about this, that without right view, there's no insight. There's no insight. So right view is very, very important in Buddhism. It's very important because all of our views, whether they're consciously held or not, and perhaps the more pernicious ones are not held very consciously, they're held unconsciously, all of our views underpin all of our actions. Our behaviour in the world is underpinned by our views about the world and views about ourselves. They may not be... Maybe views sometimes sounds like a very grand word, like we've got a worked out philosophy of life. And I don't quite mean that. It's not always very worked out. For most of us, it's a jumble of half-received notions from, you know, from borrowed truths, from adverts and the media and friends and colleagues and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, parents, of course. But nevertheless, we do carry around a whole set of assumptions about what life is and what it is to, well, what the world is. What are we doing here? And we act from those. We act from those. At the very root of those wrong views, if you like, those views that hold us back, is this view that we exist as a fixed and separate entity. That's at the heart of our wrongness, wrong view nature, the heart of the deluded mind, is this view of a fixed and separate selfhood. And that view isn't an intellectually held view. All of us can, with a little bit of thinking, understand that we're not fixed entities, that we're processes in interaction with the rest of the world around us, the environment around us. But that doesn't stop us behaving in self-centred ways. That intellectual understanding hardly touches us in terms of our behaviour. Whereas this deep underlying self-centeredness is as primal as sort of life itself. It's probably been bred into us by millennia of evolutionary development. This notion that we exist as a fixed and separate entity that must survive at all costs. That notion of clinging to life, the life clinging in us, is born of this view. So it's as deep as that. It's as deep as that. The survival instinct is what I'm trying to get at. That survival instinct in us is born of this view. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, that's fantastic, isn't it? Because it's enabled us to survive, obviously, and grow and thrive as a species. But from an enlightened perspective, it's still a limitation. It's a limitation if our aim is Buddhahood. If our limitation is just to conquer the world or be a great lover or great career person or whatever it is, then that survival instinct, that egotistical perspective is adequate, even though it leads to suffering. But if we want to aim at enlightenment, at the ending, at the transcending of all suffering, then we've got to transcend this view, this survival instinct. That's why we talk in terms of death and rebirth, spiritual death and rebirth. To let go of that view at that level will feel like death. Of course, it's not a real death, because all we're letting go of is a delusion rather than anything real. So the sword is cutting through all wrong views, and in its essence, it's cutting through that wrong view. Yeah. So maybe we'll just see if there are any final questions before we stop. Yeah.
Can I ask that spiritual rebirth seems to be, and indeed from what you described about this picture, that the goal and the pinnacle of effort, and I was wondering, where does spiritual rebirth lie in the whole, in the five stages? Is it the pinnacle? Okay. But it sounds as if it is, because you're talking about enlightenment, and that suggests that that's the goal, getting at that.
Yeah.
Is what happens after spiritual rebirth?
Yeah.
In terms of the five stages?
Yeah. All right, I'll give the game away, because I was saying earlier you'll have to wait until next year when we discover the kind of culminating system, the stage, as it were. But what happens after spiritual rebirth? Spiritual rebirth is, as you say, enlightenment itself. At its height, this is what spiritual rebirth is. All of these stages can also be viewed. Subhuti's paper and Bhante's paper recently says very clearly that they can be viewed not just as stages, but as a mandala, as aspects. So as a mandala, spiritual rebirth is an approach to reality, when every time we recollect the ideal, every time we try and connect with the goal, imaginatively or through our practice of meditation or ethics, That's moving in this direction of spiritual rebirth. Yeah? It's an aspect of spiritual path. But as a stage, you're right. Its ultimate would be enlightenment itself. Although there are lesser levels of realization before enlightenment. Yeah, there's the whole notion of becoming irreversible on the path, which is a long way from full and perfect enlightenment, but yet is something very desirable to get to, as it were. If you can think in those terms, which probably you can't. But after spiritual rebirth, there's this final stage, which is spontaneous compassionate activity. And in a way, you could say that's the goal. Because spiritual rebirth, even then, well, so what? In a certain sense. Maybe that's not quite right. That's being a bit flippant. But the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree. So that was spiritual rebirth for him. But so what for everybody else? But actually, he didn't stop there. He then spent the rest of his life trying to communicate the Dharma to as many people as he could, and then encouraging them to communicate the Dharma, setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma that's still rolling on 2.5 centuries later. So that is spontaneous compassionate activity. It's spontaneous because, unlike us being kind or compassionate or ethical, which always has a trace of egotism in it, or it has a trace, even if it's a relatively selfless act, it still has a notion behind it of me and you. An enlightened person's compassionate activity wouldn't have any such notion. They wouldn't have a notion that they are being kind or compassionate. They would just be spontaneously acting in a completely natural way, and the way that we would experience that action is as compassion. So in a sense, the spiritual life doesn't complete itself until there's that. That is the activity of enlightenment. Yeah? That is, you could say, that is, or the suprapersonal force, as Subhuti's been talking about, and Bhante's been talking about, then working through the individual for the good of the world. So often, it's very easy, isn't it, to think that Buddhism's a personal, private affair, that we're involved in our own liberation, concerned with our own freedom and happiness. And of course, that is included in the Buddhist path, but it can't be the goal. The goal has to be something that transcends me, and that has to be to do with alleviating suffering in the whole world, in the whole cosmos. That's what Buddhahood is about. You could say that Manjudosha symbolises that compassionate activity reaching down into the world. This sword, the hand that wields the sword, is active. It's the activity of the compassionate, of the enlightened mind. And if you open up to it, it will cut through your delusion. It will do that, as it were, if you ask it to, and if you open up to it. There's an active dimension that reaches down to us just as we reach up to it. And Manjudoshi could say in that sword-wielding hand is reaching down to us. Sometimes when I bow to him and prostrate on the ground, in a way, in my imagination, I'm asking him to use his sword to, you know, cut off my head. To surrender to that sword. That image might not appeal to everybody, but it does to me.
Well, just the very act of bowing is a subduing of the ego.
Yes, it's a subduing of the ego.
Does the green scarf and the green halo have any symbolism?
Yes, it does. So the green halo, the green head aura, is the aura of wisdom, and the body aura, which in this case is the sun, is the aura of punya, of merit. So I guess that's a sort of technical distinction between punya and jnana, as it's known. But you've got all the figures have this sort of wisdom aura, that is their enlightened wisdom. And then you could say that the body aura is that wisdom in action, in their actions. And the green of the scarf, of this scarf that's draped around him, well, I guess that reflects, in this image anyway, that reflects the colour of the wisdom aura. So his action in his body, his bodily action, holding the book and wielding the sword, is embraced by this wisdom. Do you see what I mean? It's wrapped around him. And for me, that scarf also evokes, it's a bit like a serpent wrapped around him. The shapes of that scarf are a bit sort of like a serpent, a python or something. And of course the serpents, the nagas, are also associated with wisdom in the Buddhist tradition. The image has, for me anyway, it has sort of serpents in, and it has flames in. There are flames everywhere, even in the they're sort of echoed in the locks of his hair. They're sort of like flames. There's flames on the side of the sun, there's flames in the sword, and then there's these sort of writhing serpent like things. Yeah. Some of that's me reading things into it. Do you see what I mean? It's not. You have to find your own readings into symbols. That's what symbols are for. Bhante says, doesn't he, that a symbol can only be a symbol for you. So I'm just trying to share what is a symbol for me. But you have to find your own. And it might not be this one. Or if it is this one, you might read it in a different way. Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like it's a very active image.
Mm.
The colours are very active.
Mm.
Image.
Mm.
Is there anything in the symbolism of meditation? Mm. Or is that just sitting in meditation?
So he's sitting in meditation. For me, this is an image that is very active. I think you're right. And Bhante says this, that the emotional tone of wisdom is metta. That is the emotional counterpart of wisdom. Without metta, it's not wisdom. Without compassion, it's not wisdom. So metta naturally wants to express itself in the world, in action. So without that activity, wisdom isn't wisdom, in a certain sense. So yes, I think it is. And this orange is the fire of metta. It's the fire of love. And yes, it's a very active figure. But when I look at least at the face, I see something very poised and balanced and still. The face for me, the gaze, is very still and penetrating and, yes, completely at rest. There's something about the gaze for me in that, as well as, of course, the seated full lotus position of meditation. And the book at the heart is quite still as well and central. But particularly the gaze. If you look at the eyes, there's something like... There's all this movement of the sword, but the eyes and the gaze feel like they've always just been looking at you. They're completely still. And there's this very, very kindly, what I interpret as kindly, but direct, no-nonsense kind of gaze. So there's a sort of active challenge, but a very, very soft, kindly face that's looking at you with tremendous compassion, tremendous understanding. Yeah. And I think Manjugosha has that paradox, because his voice, I mean, we haven't talked about his voice, but his voice... You know, Gosha means voice, so his voice is very, very important. Because he's all about communication, or one way of thinking about Manjugosha is that he's about communicating the Dharma. And he can communicate in a way that speaks to each individual completely appropriately, as if he's speaking to you just completely personally. And his voice changes depending on who he's speaking to. So it can be... A soft, kindly whisper, or it can be like a lion's roar or the sound of a thundering cloud. It can be this shattering voice that wakes you from the sleep of egotism, the most terrifying sound that you can hear, or the most gentle whisper of an invitation to grow. So yes, his voice has said to have 64 qualities, and I take that as just a lot. A lot of qualities. So yes, I think you've got that activity and that stillness.
Is the 64 all the letters of the Sanskrit?
Yes, it probably is. It's like every possible way of communicating he can communicate. So he's this embodiment of learning and wisdom, but very much that learning and wisdom communicated. It's very much about the voice and communicating the Dharma. Again, an active thing. Yeah, John.
So, you know, the burning away of the ego, of the self. You know, there's a sense of how humiliating that feels at the time. And, I'm just finding ways to connect with the love and the compassion that can go with that, you know, to help us through that.
Sure.
Because that letting go of ego is often accompanied by, well, just seeing through yourself and your actions.
Sure.
Is quite humiliating.
Sure. Can be. Can't it? So can be, yeah.
I think that glow, that orange sun, it just feels for me. Whenever there is a sun in the sky, I always want to look.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just trying to find a balance between the activity of the sword.
Yeah.
Because when you're really humiliated, I feel what we really need is for a loving, compassionate being to be with us rather than leave us on our own.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, no, I'd agree. I think that, it doesn't have to be. The burning away of egotism doesn't have to be a humiliating experience. It doesn't have to be. But often it is accompanied by humiliation. It doesn't have to be. it can be like a lotus flower just opening in the sun, and an experience of liberation and bliss. But often, yes, it's accompanied by some sort of humiliation. And I think that because it can feel like that, I think that we really need to... You can't approach spiritual death without emotional positivity. And by emotional positivity, we mean metta and shraddha. So we need as much metta and shraddha in our experience before we start to try and see through the delusion of selfhood. And without enough metta and shraddha, we're not really going to be able to see through it in a positive way, or we'll just not be able to do it. That's why certain insight practices are not taught until somebody's ready for working at that level. And Manjugosha, in a way, the way I try and approach him, the way I experience in my imagination this figure, him, is primarily as love. That's how I experience him. A sort of incredible kindness and love. And it's only in that context that I then can relate to the sword and ask to be... have my egotism severed or burnt away. It's only in the context of love. Yeah. So we have to find that ourselves. Yeah. Really, really important. In a way, when we talk about wisdom, it's very, very important that we keep the context of love and compassion at the forefront. Otherwise, wisdom just becomes some sort of hard, cold way of talking. And who wants to live like that? Buddhist wisdom, transcendental wisdom, always has the flavour of love. That doesn't mean sentimental love. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have challenge. Sometimes the word in English, love and kindness, become sentimentalised. But in a real sense, metta can have quite a lot of challenge to it. Shall we leave it there? Maybe that's a good note to leave it on. Maybe I'll finish with another quotation from Carl Sagan. I just want to go back to this balance, yes, even this tension between wisdom and love. One without the other isn't enough. One without the other isn't enough. But perhaps particularly what Manjudosha offers is this perspective that there is more beyond self-clinging. That if you do let go of self-clinging, that what you open up to is something very, very... Well, positive's too weak a word. Love is too weak a word. It's too personal a word, in a way. This is Carl Sagan again, and I think what he does beautifully is evoke this sense of vastness and perspective. For as long as there have been human beings, We have searched for our place in the cosmos. Where are we? Who are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than people. This perspective is a courageous continuation of our penchant for constructing and testing mental models of the skies. The sun as a red hot stone, the stars as a celestial flame, the galaxy as the backbone of night. As the ancient myth makers knew, we are children equally of the earth and the sky. In our tenure on this planet, we've accumulated dangerous evolutionary baggage, propensities for aggression and ritual, submission to leaders, hostility to outsiders, all of which puts our survival in some doubt. But we've also acquired compassion for others, love for our children, and desire to learn from history and experience, and the great, soaring, passionate intelligence, the clear tools for our continued survival and prosperity. Which aspects of our nature will prevail is uncertain, particularly when our visions and prospects are bound to one small part of the small planet Earth. But up there, in the immensity of the cosmos, an inescapable perspective awaits us. There are not yet any obvious signs of extraterrestrial intelligence, and this makes us wonder whether civilizations like ours always rush implacably headlong towards self-destruction. But national boundaries are not evident when we view the Earth from space. Fanatical ethnic or religious or national chauvinisms are a little difficult to maintain when we see our planet as a fragile blue crescent fading to become an inconspicuous point of light against the bastion and citadel of the stars. Travel is broadening. Is that wonderful? Okay, so we'll leave him with the last words. So now, if you want a 2 or 3 minute leg stretch, let's have that, and then we'll set up and rearrange the room a little bit for a puja.